And welcome back to Current State, where it's a live music Friday. We are delighted to welcome back Taylor Taylor to Current State here on Live Music Friday. Very talented singer, guitarist, songwriter who's become more or less a fixture on the local music scene. Her second EP has not been out that long. It's called Right Here. Let's hear a track called Candy Store.
Can't stop myself from smiling all the time. It's the thought of you that gets me through. Face to face, your hands on my waist. I don't wanna say goodbye. It's crystal clear what I feel when you're not like those other guys. You're everything and more that I've been looking for. That I've been looking for. That I've been looking for. To a candy store, you know that I'll be yours for as long as you let me. I'll be yours. Ooh, with you, I wanna spend all of my time. No, it don't matter where. If I'm with you, then I don't care.
Candy Store is Taylor Taylor here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. Taylor's been on the program before, but I can't tell you how refreshing and how cool it is just to hear you with these two other great players.
Thank you. It's, I know, just, these guys are amazing.
It's just, you were great solo. Don't misunderstand my comments, but just to hear you with Larry Trice III on keys and vocal harmonies and Austin Tipton doing a great job on the drums. It is just energizing. Energizing. And we'll hear more from you here in just a few minutes. Current State features live music every Friday. If this and all of the other reporting and content that you hear on this show is a part of your routine, can we ask you to make a contribution to WKAR? We formally ended our campaign yesterday, but you can still show your support and donate securely online at WKAR.org. A dollar a day pledge will go a long way toward Live Music Friday and Current State. Coverage of the local news you depend on. Do it now, WKAR.org, and we thank you. Michigan voters will determine two of the seven state Supreme Court justices coming up on Election Day. Incumbent Republicans David Viviano and Joan Larson and their challengers all appear on the November ballot. Currently, Republicans hold a 5-2 majority on the Michigan Supreme Court. Joining me now to talk about the race is someone with a pretty good view of the legal system, Shayna Roths, our newest reporter with the Michigan Public Radio Network and a former county assistant prosecutor. Shayna, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having
me. Great to have you here. I do want to talk about the Supreme Court race. That was really the reason we called you originally about this. But there were some number of developments yesterday regarding the situation in Flint. You covered a Senate vote yesterday that may create a couple of very significant measures for the city. What did the Senate approve yesterday?
So the Senate essentially passed through to the House two bills. One is to create an 11-member authority in Flint, and that authority is going to be charged with getting different funding for the Flint water crisis through taxing of property, borrowing money, issuing revenue bonds. And the idea behind this is that, you know, this authority can focus on the water crisis and focus on, you know, that, and then that allows city government to, you know, get into their normal everyday activities, policing, and focus on that. So that was the first one, and that passed pretty much unanimously by the Senate. And then the other one is to create this so-called promise zone. And we saw this in Kalamazoo and in a few other cities in Michigan have those. And what that does is it creates a public-private fund, which is going to give money to high school students for college scholarships as long as they go to school in the city.
Have you heard of any response from Mayor Weaver, from Jim Ananick, or Representative Kildee? How are people responding to this, if at all?
Well, the two bills are Ananick's bills, so obviously he's very in favor of them. And like I said, the Senate was really on board with them. The interesting thing at play with this legislation and then sort of this whole stuff that's going on in Flint right now is there was this report that came out by Senator Stamos. It was 2 days ago this report got issued,
right,
and it's all of this legislative, things that the legislature should be doing to help Flint and also to prevent another Flint water crisis. The interesting thing, though, is that Stamos, he just kind of released it. It's sort of from the board, but the board never, or this committee that was gathered to talk about Flint, but the committee never voted on it. They never got necessarily a final say on this report that was released. So I think that sort of interplay there of, you know, what's going on with this committee and this report and, you know, kind of how are we kind of meeting to discuss what we should be doing, not only about Flint, but about how to prevent another water crisis and how to fix infrastructure is going to be, you know, kind of the things that we're going to be looking at going forward.
Let's turn to the Michigan Supreme Court now. As we said, the GOP holds the majority on the court. Let's talk about the two incumbents trying to retain their seats, David Viviano and Joan Larson. What contributions have they made to the court? What's been their impact on this court?
The court has been interesting the last little while in that they've been really chill. There hasn't been a lot of infighting. They've really seemed to have gotten along, and Viviano and Larson have contributed to that. Both of them are very textual interpreters of the Constitution, meaning that they believe in, you know, sticking to the four corners of the document, as opposed to just kind of looking at it as like this sort of like living, breathing document, which is another way of interpreting the Constitution. Justice Larson, as a lot of people know, is she is on Republican nominee Donald Trump's kind of short list for a potential Supreme Court nominee if and when he is elected president. She was also a clerk for Justice Scalia. And during her time, she's been a very strong advocate for different treatment courts like sobriety court and things like that. So that's kind of been where she's been at. And then you got Justice Viviano, who has been in charge of training different judges and making transitions to different e-filing systems in the lower courts. One interesting thing I think about Viviano is that he's been this sort of champion of video conferencing, which is, you know, it takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of resources, and it also can occasionally impact safety when you have to bring different people in, you know, to and from the jails to the court system. So he has been a proponent of, you know, installing different video conferencing systems so that they don't have to keep bringing different defendants back and forth to court.
Justices Viviano and Larson each have challengers for their seats.
They do.
What do we know about them?
You know, not a whole lot. This has been a very quiet race. I'm sure there are probably some people who weren't even aware that we were electing a Michigan Supreme Court justice.
It's usually that way.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And you know, there really hasn't been a lot of advertising for them. You know, I did sort of an informal poll talking to different people, you know, about what do you know about the Supreme Court justices? Some of them didn't know that there was a race. I was very aware driving here and walking around yesterday looking for different signs. Haven't seen any signs, haven't gotten any mailers for them. But what I was able to find is that, you know, Larson is being challenged on the quote unquote Democratic side by Deborah Thomas. And I say quote unquote because we have this idea that our justices are nonpartisan. You know, they show up in a nonpartisan part of the ballot, which gets tricky for some people because if you wanted to just vote for a Democrat or vote for a Republican, unless you do your homework, you don't know what side they are. So Thomas is technically the Democratic representative. She is also in favor of more specialty courts. And she is one of those people who believes that the Constitution should be interpreted, you know, for today, for our times. And it's this living, breathing, ever-evolving document. And then you got Frank Szymanski. He has been a Wayne County probate court judge for quite a long time, and he is going to be challenging Justice Viviano, and that's
the main opposition there.
Yeah.
In those cases, we're talking about the race to fill two seats on the Michigan Supreme Court. There are two Republican incumbent justices hoping to retain their spots on the bench. Justice David Viviano is running for a full 8-year term. Justice Joan Larson is running to complete the term vacated by retired Justice Mary Beth Kelly. Our guest is the Michigan Public Radio Network political reporter Shana Roth, who covers the state capitol along with Rick Pluta. Let's take a look at the impact of some recent decisions by the Supreme Court. There's a couple in particular that were noteworthy during the last term. Back in May, the court decided on a case involving what's loosely called pay or stay. This refers to whether to jail persons who were unable to pay their court fines. And this has been a national issue as well. How did our Supreme Court, what did they have to say about this?
So our court basically said that, you know, we need to encourage judges to work with defendants when they can't pay their fines and fees. You know, they should be encouraging setting up payment plans, reducing payments, or doing community service in lieu of fines. And the interesting thing about this whole idea of pay to stay, which is kind of, you know, it's not just to kind of condense it into just saying it's pay to stay. It's the quick headline of how to explain it. But one of the things that people really need to think about is there's a big difference between people who are being jailed just because they can't pay and the idea that, you know, they're being jailed because they didn't necessarily communicate with the court or they didn't, you know, kind of explain that that they have these obstacles, that they're not being able to pay.
Okay.
There are some, you know, judges that are very, you know, strict with this. You know, you come in, you don't pay your fine, okay, that's X amount of days in jail. But there are also a lot of judges out there and a lot of judges that I've worked with and know people who've worked with who are very willing to, if you come to them and you say, hey, look, I'm looking for a job, this is what I'm doing, I just can't afford it right now, that they will work with you. That being said, you know, the court case is important to ensure that a lot of judges are doing that, you know, and have that sort of external motivation to work with defendants.
We mentioned earlier that you have a legal background. You're a law school graduate and served for a while as the assistant Ionia County prosecutor. Why did you leave the legal field and become a reporter?
For a lot of reasons. You know, I loved working in Ionia County. It's a great small county. I was one of a couple assistant prosecuting attorneys. I focused mostly on misdemeanors and different prison cases. But for me, I found that there was just something that wasn't quite there for me. You know, I really liked the investigative part of it. I liked, you know, kind of digging deep into different ideas and different cases. That was a struggle when I became a reporter in that I used to just get police reports and documents. They just appeared on my desk. And now it's like, oh, I have to file for these things. I have to go through FOIA. I have to go through this whole process right to get all of this information. But really what it was is there was just something missing. I missed telling stories. I missed, you know, kind of looking at an issue from all sides of it. And when you're a lawyer, you really have an obligation and a duty to say, this is my side and this is the side I'm going to represent. So there was that. And, you know, as I was realizing this wasn't quite what I wanted to do, wasn't quite what I was expecting, I found myself driving to and from work every day listening to NPR. And as I was driving, I was just like, gosh, they tell the coolest stories.
I want to be Nina Schultenberg.
Yes, it was. And that's what it was. You know, it was just like, wow, you know, this is, you know, something that it sounds really interesting and that I'm really learning from. And I want to be that for people. And a friend of mine, I was, you know, kind of explaining what I liked about the law, what I didn't like, what I was missing. And they were like, well, why don't you be a journalist? And I was like, well, that sounds really cool. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I was very fortunate to have an incredibly supportive family who, when I said, I want to leave my job and go back to school yet again.
Invaluable
yes.
support there.
Yes.
We are glad you could carve out some time to join us here today. Shayna Roth covers the Michigan legislature for the Michigan Public Radio Network alongside Rick Pluta. She's also a former Ionia County assistant prosecuting attorney. We've been talking about the Michigan Supreme Court. Thanks for making time for us today.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
There's nothing better than waking up in the hazy days with you. The daylight barely showing through the window of your bedroom. And I love it, love waking up to those blue-green eyes of yours. It makes me wanna thank the Lord. That I'm here, just come here. Come closer, closer, closer. I wanna be closer, closer, closer. Pull me closer, closer, closer. As close as this world allows. Now I know what all the hype's about, and I can't believe I'm saying these things out loud. And I can't believe you're really here with me now. So let my head rest on your chest and hear your heartbeat. You feel your heartbeat. When you say that, I wish we could stay here. But no worries, no fear, no apprehension, conscience clear. I need just one volunteer. Well, how about you, sir? I'll step right up, just come here. Come closer, closer, closer. I wanna be closer, closer, closer. Pull me closer, closer, closer. As close as this world allows. Now I know what all the hype's about, and I can't believe I'm saying these things out loud. I can't believe you're really here with me. Now. It's such a shame that we can't promise we won't change. So while you're here and while I'm here, we'll let the world outside us disappear. I whisper in your ear to come closer, closer, closer. Closer, 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 closer. Closer, closer, closer. I wanna be closer, closer, closer. Pull me closer, closer, closer. As close as this world allows. Now I know what all the hype's about, and I can't believe I'm saying these things out loud. I can't believe you're really here with me now.
Very, very nice. Taylor Taylor singing and playing guitar there. It's called Closer, a song so new it's not on any either of
unreleased,
not on either of your existing EPs, and sounding just great there. Supported by Larry Trice III on keyboards and drummer Austin Tipton. More from Taylor Taylor and Company coming up here on Alive Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you're along today. The very point of a cemetery suggests that the dead belong to the earth. But when abandoned cemeteries succumb to the ravages of time, maybe it makes sense to dig some things up. That's the reasoning of one Michigan high school teacher. Darren Sylvester's history students have spent the last 11 years slowly unearthing an abandoned, nearly one-acre cemetery in Plymouth Township, not far from Ann Arbor. They're not digging up the dead, but they are studying and sometimes replacing gravestones and landscaping. In the process, Mr. Sylvester's Salem High School students learn about the history of their hometown. I spoke with him yesterday and first asked him when he learned of the Shearer Cemetery and how his idea took shape.
Well, I first took a Michigan history class over that had been sort of waffling around and nobody really wanted to take it. And it was summer of 2005, and I was trying to look for something more authentic to do with my students. The students were a whole mix of different academic abilities, and I was trying to do things that were more, I guess you would say, hands-on or more authentic than just teaching them, here's the state flower, here's the state bird, or whatever it might be. So I was at the Plymouth Historical Museum where I volunteered at times, and I was looking to do some information and find some information about our big cemetery, Riverside. And a gentleman in there named Gary put me on to this cemetery and said nobody knows anything about it. And I, having lived in the community basically my whole life, knew nothing about it either. And I'm a history guy who likes cemeteries, so I was interested. And so I went to drive out there the next morning, and it was a hot summer morning in August, and I was told where it was, and I drove right by it. And I stopped my car and I said, okay, I missed. And I drove right by it the other way. And then I stopped my car and drove by it a third time. And I said, pulled over and said, okay, you're not this foolish. You should probably figure out, where do you think a cemetery would be? It's on a high point of ground. And so I realized, I looked back and I found this highest point of ground, and that's when I found the cemetery. Not exactly finding it, you know, other people had known it was there, but at this point it had been abandoned with the exception of a couple burials there, for probably over about 120 years.
Describe the setting of this abandoned cemetery for us.
It's 0.6 acres. It's up on a hill on North Territorial Road. It's about a half a mile due west of Sheldon on the north side. So the first time I pulled out in my car and I walked up and tried to find a place to go in, and it was so covered with brush and weeds and vines and everything that I tried to find the most open spot I could, and up near the neighbor's yard, there's a subdivision just to the north of it. And I went in a little opening that was there, and I kind of beat my way through the brush to get to the middle. And seriously, it took 15 minutes to 20 minutes to just get to the middle. It had covered more or less like a rainforest with vine all over the place, probably up to 20, 25 feet high. And so when I got through there, my arms were bleeding. I was foolish. I just had a t-shirt on. I finally got my way to the middle, and I had found one stone that was there. There were other, you know, sort of the set stones, the original ones that go into the ground that the larger stones would set in. That were on the ground, and you could see that there were spots where people were buried where the stones were, but they were all askew. They were all in different directions. They were tilted over, and you really couldn't see much underneath your feet because everything was entirely covered, probably 10 feet over top of my head minimum.
When did people stop being buried there?
The last guy to be buried there was J.J. Scher back in 1915, and they built up a mausoleum. His father was a pretty important figure in our community, ran for office, served in the state house, was asked to run for governor for a period of time, was on the short list to do that, and he became a pretty well-known figure, assisted in, you know, helping raise money and gain interest to get people to go and serve in the Civil War for us. So he was a big figure, and this was one of his sons. We pulled a letter from the Plymouth Mail, which is our newspaper of the time, a letter to the editor in November of 1889 that was by John S. Tibbetts, who was the original landowners of the property. And he said that it was, when I got it, it was sort of a needle in the haystack. He said, I was looking to be buried in a place where all my kindred were buried as well. But when I came there, it was such a mess of tangled brush and weeds and everything else that I couldn't even locate where they were buried. And then he says something to the effect of, this is unbecoming of a Christian community, that they should have paid better attention and cared more for this specific site. And so we kind of took it as more or less, we found it early and we took it almost as our own calling to see what we could do to try to kind of heed his words back in 1889. It was a mess then, and it was a mess now, some 115, 20 years later.
Darren Sylvester is a history teacher at Salem High School in the Plymouth Canton School District in southeast Michigan. We're talking about the 11 years that he and his students have been studying and restoring an abandoned cemetery in Plymouth Township, northeast of Ann Arbor. Do you know how it was that the Shearer Cemetery came to be abandoned in the first place? How does that happen?
The belief is that there was Native Americans that were buried there, and some of the oldest citizens used to see some old spots that they had, Native American names. And then it became a family plot for the Tibbetts, and then the continuation of whatever was married into that family. And then it grew from there, from a family plot, a little bit more to a sort of a road-based family spot. Everybody who was up and down North Territorial began burying their loved ones there. And over time, these guys who came to Plymouth were some of the original people to go west. And at that point, the properties were sold off to people that were no longer family members. And this spot on a hill seems to sort of go away on its own. The last thing they need to do is all work on the cemetery. And no one else was left to care for it because it wasn't township run, township organized.
You learned about the tragic death of a boy, Hiram Jerome Tibbetts, who died at the age of 9 and was buried there. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, the guy that I was talking to you about, John S. Tibbetts, that's Hiram's older brother. There was a family of about 11 children, and they all made their way out here from New York in 1825, Hiram being the youngest of the bunch to make it out this way. Neighbors were miles apart at the time, and so at the Tibbetts' house, which is still there just on the south side of Territorial Road, about a quarter mile maybe west of the cemetery, there was a big gathering of all the people who were coming from, I would have to assume, from many miles away, who were all coming out for some specific function. And at that time, the children, and I try to talk to my kids about this, about structured play and unstructured play. In the old days, you're just get outside, go do something, and get out of the way. Well, John S., who was probably 6 or 7 at the time, took his 5-year-old brother down the street, and they were down at the home that would be at the corner of Sheldon Road and Penniman. And there was a boy that was hired out there, 16 years old, who was hired to cut wood and to chop up a bunch of wood for fuel or for whatever they were using for that time, cooking, whatever. And as they were doing it, the little boys, both John S. and his brother, were grabbing all the wood chips that were coming off of the axe, and they were running over to the pig pen, and they were just chucking the wood chips up at the pigs. Just, I guess that was their amusement, their fun of the time. Well, Hiram wasn't paying attention, and he ran back over as the boy was bringing the axe down into the log and took the axe down and hit the boy on the top of the head. Now, this is a 5-year-old who's, the person in charge, the responsible one, should be maybe the 16-year-old chopping the wood. Well, the 16-year-old hits him in the head with the axe, and he just runs away, leaving the 7-year-old brother there to take care of this child. And so he had no clue what to do at that point, so he just grabbed his brother, and they ran with a big open fracture in the top of his skull, bleeding profusely, all the way back out 3/4 of a mile down the dirt area and back to the home. And luckily, some of the people that were at the home, there were a couple physicians who were there who tended to Hiram. And it's amazing to see that in the write-up that we get from John S. Tibbetts, that his brother was, they pulled some fragments of skull from his brain that they could see open and throbbing. But the kid was up and about a week later, so pretty tough. I would imagine that would be quite a concussion, but the kid was up and about a week later. But what would happen to him is a few years after that is, it seems as though cholera was big in 1832. It had killed a number of people in August of 1832. And the assumption is because it says that he died of the fever in August of 1832, that same sickness must have worked its way out to this area as well, as people traveled back and forth to Detroit for goods and other people made their way out here. So the boy did die, his brother said, of the fever at 9 years, 10 months old on August 23rd of 1832.
I know you feel pretty strongly about experiential learning. That's obvious. Describe what it's like for your students to connect these headstones with the stories of these people's lives.
Well, great question. Thank you. That's really the part that I I hope to get the most out for my kids is we get there and I tell a quick story about the students. I tell some, about the people buried there. And I spend maybe 15, 20 minutes telling some stories so that there's a personal connection to it. This isn't just some 6/10 of an acre spot with, you know, flowers and paths and a couple stones. But these are the original people. These are the original pioneers who came out here and purchased land for 80 acres for $100. And they made the community that we have today that their parents came to settle. So when we do this, the kids get a little bit more into who these people are, and they understand a little bit more the importance of the individuals who are out there. And so they find a purpose to why they're there, and they connect to that. The other part that's so good to me is we don't have shop classes. We don't have things where kids use their hands. We don't have any of those that I think we desperately still need. But you get the kid outside, and they cut a hosta in two, and they figure out that you didn't just kill it. You planted something into the earth. You worked with some other kids around you. In many cases, when these kids have to do, they do a write-up for me, like, what did you do? What did you do when, or what did you think when you were going there? What did you do when you were there? And what did you think when you left? And one of the big things is a lot of the students say, I was nervous. I wasn't sure if any of my friends would show up. You weren't going to let me use any technology. And so they do that. And in many cases, they come and there's not a specific friend of theirs, but they quickly make new friends while they're either shoveling mulch, digging a hole, planting some plants, moving some rocks, looking for any other old stones that might still be in there. And their write-ups talk about how much they enjoyed meeting some new people, how they enjoyed the shared experience, that they enjoyed the fact that for 3 hours on that day, they got away from their phones and they were outside. And I joke with them when they're sweating that I know this might be the first time that you're sweating, but it's okay. It's not an unhealthy thing. It's a good thing for you. And we have a good laugh about stuff like that. And I think their responses in their papers say that commonly.
It's a long shot, but I have to ask, by any chance, have any of your students discovered they've had a connection with anybody that was buried in the cemetery?
None that I can tell. We do a family tree in my Michigan history courses. So I teach civics, Michigan history, in a class called American Culture and Baseball. But in those two classes, we do some stuff about family tree, like the Michigan history one. We do some family tree. And I've had a number of students whose family members date all the way back to the 1820s and 30s, but in Plymouth and around, and would have been people who would have connected to individuals that were there, but none that are directly any lineage that I see. That would be fun, but it hasn't happened yet.
You started this project 11 years ago. I have to ask if it's motivated any of your students to continue any kind of archaeological study or endeavors.
I have students who will send me little articles about where they are. You know, 11 years has gone a long time and kids are spread out all across the country. And you commonly get some emails that say, hey, this is a cemetery that's being done in my community outside of Nashville. I don't see that they're out there working on those things. For me, the biggest was, you know, my mom used to take me to cemeteries and things like that. She kind of had an affection for them. I had a sister who passed away really young. And so she went to old cemeteries and kind of looked, and the old ones had things that said infants. And so when I went there, commonly with my mom, we would see them and they would be broken apart. And so getting the kids in there is more or less to just make sure that I'm going to have, you know, thousands of students who've gone through there over the years now, and that they know that my students aren't ones that are going to go through there late at night, drink a bunch of beers and kick over a bunch of stones. I feel the connection that they've had to this reduces the potential opportunity for any other teenagers or young adults to make some pretty horrible decisions.
How many more years do you plan to work on the Shearer Cemetery? How much more work does it have in it?
Mostly it's just it's upkeep at this point. The stones themselves, many of the stones are sadly beyond repair. A lot of the broken parts are disconnected and you don't have anything that we can reattach them to. So to continuation is a couple times a year, sometimes as many as four. We get the students in there. We try to just continue to work the paths. We continue to plant more flowers. So when we find or learn more of it, we're beginning to, you know, hopefully if we find more stones. There were three stones that were found in the backyard of a home in downtown Lower Town or Old Town Plymouth. So then they contacted us. And we find that there's record in an 1860 map that shows the family lived just adjacent to where the cemetery was. We had three other stones or four other stones that a man called me up who had taken the stones back in the 60s when he was a high school student and still had them and asked to return those. While we have no, you know, clear understanding as to where they would be in the cemetery, we do bring the stones back. We put them in there. If they can stand up, we plan them up so that they can stand up. So it's an imperfect plan, but I think the overall goal of the students, their connection, their ability to understand who came here first, what they did, and how they created a pretty darn good community that they get to live in today, you know, the respect that comes for that, I think, is more important to me than fix every stone. So I imagine I have anywhere from 5 years left to teach to as long as I can. It all depends on all depends on my salary. I have to be truthful as to whether or not I can continue. What I hope to do is continue it for as long as I can here, and then beyond that is to hopefully pass it on to somebody else who would continue the process and with the next generation of kids who come after me.
Darren Sylvester is a history teacher at Salem High School in the Plymouth-Canton School District in southeast Michigan. We've been talking about the 11 years he and his students have been restoring and studying an abandoned cemetery in Plymouth Township, northeast of Ann Arbor. We also want to thank Salem student radio station WSDP and its manager Bill Keith for his help with this interview. Darren Sylvester, great talking with you.
Mark, great talking to you. Thank you very much for having me and for sharing the story.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Can you imagine if you had to put coins in your radio every time you check in for news or reporting on WKAR? Would you do that? How much would you pay every day? A lot of WKAR listeners give a dollar a day. If WKAR keeps you in touch with what's happening in Michigan and Current State, pledge a dollar a day now at WKAR.org. Our campaign ended formally yesterday, but there's still time for you to share your support at WKAR.org. And if you've already taken care of that business, we thank you. Taylor Taylor is back here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. She's backed by Larry Trice III on keyboards and drummer Austin Tipton. Let's hear a track from the EP called Right Here. This is called Pluto.
He says they're only friends, but there's no way to pretend there's nothing more. Unfortunately, and I've tried my very best not to sabotage or protest. What message would that send about me? And is it possible that there's a slightest chance? Is our slim, but I love who I become when I'm with him. The slightest chance is I slim, but I love who I become when I'm with him. One day, oh, maybe one day, when Pluto is a planet again. One day, oh, maybe one day, he will see. Seems a little empty. If it were me, I would approve Pluto's re-entry.
And I apologize, no, I don't mean to whine. But I think we'd be better including planet number 9. One day, oh, maybe one day, when Pluto is a planet again. One day, oh, maybe one day, he will see me differently.
Taylor Taylor, the song is called Pluto. Things will be different when Pluto is a planet again.
Yes,
how,
sir.
How long did it take to work out? That is such a clever approach.
Thank you.
Lyrical approach to telling a story and writing a song. How long did it take to get that idea? Where'd that idea come from?
You know, surprisingly, this was actually one of the fastest songs that I've written, and I think it's because it's a unique topic, and there was kind of a lot to say about it that hadn't necessarily been said in song form before, so it was really easy to just, like, crank out. And
you'll hear people say, though, that'll happen when pigs fly or when hell freezes over
right.
or something like that. Is that a song of hope, or is that a song of despair?
That is up to you.
Ah, up to the listener. What was it to you? Or is that digging too deep?
Oh, no. You know, sometimes when I write things, I don't really have anything in mind specifically sometimes. And it's just, you know, writing the song for the sake of songwriting and for the sake of feeling it
I
and
get
being
it.
Able to sing it. So it's
I get
really,
it.
You know, sometimes there isn't really anything
yeah.
in mind. And
No, I understand. The first time we talked with you was before the Common Ground Music Festival in Lansing 3 years ago. At the time you were 16 years old, Okemos High student, getting ready to play there. We had you play live for us on the show last year. Now you're here on the show again with your most recent EP, which I think you alluded to on your last visit, actually. It's called Right Here.
Yes.
And you're also at Lansing Community College.
Still,
still performing and recording around your academic schedule. What's that like?
It's really nice this semester because I scheduled my classes to be Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So it's nice to have Thursday and Friday, and then of course Saturday and Sunday off to do music stuff or homework if I need to, but mostly music stuff.
But do you have more time as a college student, or did you have more time as a high school student? I guess that's my question.
Definitely more time in college. I'm not at school from
right.
8 to 3 or whatever every day.
Yeah.
And so if there's something in the morning like this, for example, I can come and not have to worry about missing class.
Understood. Tell us what you're studying at LCC.
I'm studying commercial music, so it's kind of a mix of music performance, of theory, and a little bit of production, and a little bit of the business side, too.
And with graduation's very soon.
It is. It's the end of this coming spring, which
yeah.
is crazy to me.
What?
Went by so fast.
Oh, it happens all the time, yeah. What do you have planned after that?
Ooh, after I graduate from LCC, I really want to make the move out to LA and do the scene out there, so maybe these guys will come with me.
Oh, it sounds like an invitation. I don't know. Life in Lansing is pretty good. Los Angeles, Lansing.
LA, Lansing area.
West LA and East LA is what we got there. Tell us about these two guys. How'd you hook up with Larry Trice III and Austin Tipton? Larry's on keyboards today, and Austin's on drums.
Man, these guys are incredible, as you heard them earlier.
It is great to hear you beefed up. I mean, you were super solo. I mean, don't get me wrong. We don't regret a single time that you've been on the show, but it's just great to hear you with a rhythm section, you know?
Yeah, they just add so much to the performance. It's weird playing solo one day, and then next day I'll be with the band, and then next day solo again, and it'll feel so empty. I'm like, oh, I miss those little runs that Larry would do, or those little like kicks that Austin would do.
Oh yeah, no, it's great having a rhythm section here. Larry, how long you been playing the piano?
I've been playing for 10 years now. Started when I was about 13. My dad kind of got me into it because he played and. Rest is, I guess they say, history. So,
yeah. How long have you been playing with Taylor?
I've been playing with Chief here for
Chief.
For about a year. Last August was like our first gig, so yeah, it was just like magic since the first time we played. So
I'm not surprised to hear that. Mm-hmm. You're a Lansing guy?
Yeah, I'm a Lansing guy. I should start changing that up because people usually ask me where I'm from, and I say Lansing. Like, I want to have something that's just like incredible, like. Maine or something that just, like, sticks out. Like, I'm from
Maine,
there, so
Maine's incredible.
Well, I guess when you say it like that, probably not. But I gotta have a backstory.
It's out of the ordinary.
Yeah,
that's what you're trying to say. I get it. And Austin Tipton, how long you been playing the drums?
I've been playing the drums since I came out the womb, but I've been taking it serious for like four years since I was 18. I'm 22 now. So.
Okay. How old were you when you had your first drum set?
My mom made sure I got my first drum set at like 5 years old. So,
whoa,
drum set when I was young.
Been at it a long time. Well, it shows. It shows. You guys all sound really, really good.
Thank you. You've
been busy doing some voiceover work as well, Taylor.
A little bit.
What are you doing?
I did a thing for.
This is spoken word. This is like narration or things like that, or what? Commercials or what?
Yeah, mostly commercial stuff.
Okay.
There was a thing with like the Capital Area District Library and just other voiceover work when people need it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You guys all play at a church as well. Tell us about that.
Go ahead.
We all play. Austin, not so much now. He kind of travels from church to church. But we all Tabernacle of David Church. It's a church where my dad is the pastor, Larry Trice Jr., hence I'm the third. And so we kind of all started there together, me, Austin, and my brother, who's not here today, Lawrence. We all kind of started there at Tabernacle of David. So.
Okay. You play there too as well, Austin?
Yeah, I play drums there, but I'm playing keys full-time at Union Baptist on MLK. So.
Oh, impressive. Multi-instrumentalist.
Trying.
This guy's good. Taylor, you recorded the theme song a while back for the Michigan Parks and Recreation Association for the same people who did the Pure Michigan campaign. The song is called Come Out to Play. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Hey, hey, let's get away. The perfect day, tell me twice you want to stay. Ask me nice, and I just may. Hey, 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 come out and play.
We got just a few seconds. Tell us a little bit about that project.
It was at a really cool studio, Gessian Studios, and it was just really, it was so much fun. They documented everything, and they showed me this song, and so I learned it right there, and recorded it, and now it's used for the Parks and Rec Association.
So people are hearing that, and they're thinking, oh, that's a local, that's Taylor.
Yeah, and I hear that that's the song that plays, like, if you call them and get put on hold, then you get to listen to me for a little bit.
We want to thank all of you here for being here today.
You
really brightened up the day. Taylor, Larry Trice III, Austin Tipton play us out. They play this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Well, Taylor plays this afternoon at Uncle John's Cider Mill. Do I have that right?
Correct. From 4 to 7, I'll be there.
All right. Very good. More from Taylor and friends to take us home here on Current State. We wish you all the best of luck.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I've never been in a clique for anyone to mess with. There's no drama queens or queen bees around here. I'm not as lucky as the cool kids with the hybrid cars or the close friends of the movie stars, but I can live with everything I'm not. And I'm still waiting for reality to come and give me life. So until then, I'll sit tight right here. Yeah, right here's where I should be. And here is where I'm happy. And nothing can stop me. I've got everything right here. Never broken a heart or had mine broken apart, because ain't nobody got time for that, and I'd rather not make time for that. Like love songs on the radio, what it feels like, I don't know. So until then, I'll sit tight right here. Yeah, right here is where I should be. And here is where I'm happy. And nothing can stop me. I've got everything right here. Yeah, yeah. I've got no time to complain.